The headlines this hour: military cooperation between Iran and Russia on the upswing. The top Iranian general says the two countries will work together to eradicate terrorism in Syria. Britain reports a further 179 coronavirus-related daily deaths and more than 49,000 new cases. And massive flooding and landslides cause a trail of destruction in India and in Nepal, leaving over 150 people dead and dozens missing in both countries. Thanks for joining us. Tehran and Moscow will continue their strategic cooperation to help establish sustainable security in the region. That's according to the chief of the General Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri. The top general has met with senior Russian military officials during an ongoing visit to Russia. He says the two sides discussed expanding cooperation in fighting international terrorism, which has been a top concern in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and the Caucasus region. Bagheri also talked about the future arms contracts between Tehran and Moscow. The Iranian general said that all these issues would be discussed in detail in a joint military commission scheduled in 3 months in Tehran. Israeli media reports say the regime has allocated nearly $1.5 billion for potential strikes against Iran's nuclear sites. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our news review program. The Israeli regime has reportedly allocated a budget of some $1.5 billion to prepare its military for potential attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities. Israeli media say that the budget is slated to be approved by the regime's cabinet in November. The reports say the budget includes funds for various kinds of warplanes, spy drones, and arms needed for such attacks. Last week, Israel and its main backer, the U.S., renewed their military threats against the Islamic Republic over its nuclear activities. Iran maintains that its nuclear program is peaceful and subject to rigorous international inspections, while Israel allows no such checks and possesses hundreds of nuclear warheads. Tehran has also repeatedly warned Israel and its allies against any kind of military adventurism, saying that such a move will receive a crushing response. Robert Pantina is an author and journalist joining us from Kitchener. And we also have Keaton Mansfield, author and analyst, the Center for Political Innovation, who joins us from New York. I'd like to welcome you both. And Keaton Mansfield, let me first start with you. So you have Israel that has allocated this money with the aim of, I guess, possibly attacking Iran's nuclear facilities. So let me get this straight here. You're having this announcement being made publicly, while Israel has been accused by Iran to have attacked its nuclear facilities already. An incident that happened not on just one occasion, more than one occasion. So is Israel admitting to something that it's going to do in the future?
Well, it's hard to say for sure if Israel will carry out attacks against Iran. We certainly hope that it's an empty threat, but Israel has done things, and the U.S. have made similar acts of aggression in the past, be it assassinating Soleimani or putting Iran under sanctions. I mean, the list goes on and on. And so perhaps Israel is not announcing prematurely that it is going to attack Iran or going to do everything in its power to prohibit Iran from pursuing an advancement in the nuclear program and in nuclear testing, because that would seem very foolish from a tactical standpoint. The strategy of prematurely announcing that there's going to be an attack or that they're preparing to act aggressively towards Iran's nuclear program seems unlikely, but it could be just the opposite. It could be Israel waving around a gun, so to speak, and threatening that unless it gets what it wants, unless the UN continues to turn a blind eye to Israel's military and to the illegal and unjustified actions of Israel that the Zionist state, with the backing of the U.S., with the backing of NATO, is prepared to attack Iran.
I mean, this is unprecedented, Robert Fantina, isn't it? We're talking about Israel, allocating this budget for potentially attacking Iran. And wait a minute, Israel is already attacking another sovereign nation, and that's Syria, repeatedly, maybe in the hundreds. And, of course, Iran to have accused Israel of attacking its nuclear facilities on more than one occasion, killing its nuclear scientists, etc. So my question, again, comes to the fact that is Israel admitting its guilt before it commits another act, which it's allocated money for it?
Israel doesn't see any guilt in what it does. Israel, like the United States, considers itself above the law, and the United States paves the way for it to do so. Israel has assassinated nuclear scientists in the past. As you mentioned, it's bombing Syria. It's a rogue nation. It's an apartheid nation, and it doesn't care to follow international rules. Unfortunately and tragically, the global community has allowed it to get away with its crimes against humanity and its violation of international law for decades. This needs to change. Right now, Israel may be issuing this threat and approving this money to force Tehran to negotiate, to renegotiate the JCPOA. The government of Iran says it is willing to re-enter the JCPOA when the other parties adhere to the agreement. It makes no sense for one party to adhere to the agreement and the others not to. And that is what is expected now. The United States violated international and U.S. law when Donald Trump, as president, withdrew from JCPOA, it had the approval of Congress, the entrance into the JCPOA had the approval of Congress, the departure did not. The United Nations had given a seal of approval to the agreement. So it is the United States and Israel that are continually violating international law. The government of Iran wants to protect its people from threats, and certainly the threats that the United States and Israel present are great and real. And the Iranian government has not only the right, but the responsibility to do what's necessary to protect its people.
Putting aside the fact, Keith Mansfield, I'm not a technician, but I'm assuming that when you attack a nuclear facility, that there's going to be consequences that could be very fatal, in terms of anything that comes out of that in the form of contamination. So putting that aside, and putting aside the fact that Israel does have an active nuclear program, it's got nuclear warheads, does the U.S. military aid, which is in the billions, I think $3.7 billion a year, be part of this $1.5 billion, or for the $1.5 billion to be part of that U.S. military aid, which would then mean that the U.S. is also part of this potential attack on Iran if Israel wanted to?
Oh, I'm sure that's the case. Israel would be nothing without the backing of the U.S., without the backing of entities controlled and influenced by the U.S. I mean, the U.S. has proposed billions of dollars to go to the Iron Dome missile program. The U.S. has sent billions of dollars in weaponry in the past, as well as training countless IDF soldiers, and in turn, IDF soldiers training New York police officers. And so should Israel enter into a hot conflict with Iran, should the stalemate or the kind of the cold aggression between the two countries turn hot, I feel certain that the U.S. would intervene. The U.S. would step in on the side of Israel, would back the Israeli aggression, which in turn would draw Syria into the fray, and potentially Afghanistan, Russia, China. I mean, the possibilities are endless if the U.S. were to support a war or further attacks against Iran. And Iran would have no option but to defend itself. We've seen time and time again that the U.S., if it's given an inch, it will take a mile. And so Iran will be forced to stand strong against U.S. aggression, the kind of attempting to negotiate and be friendly with the U.S. and with U.S. policy, has proven unsuccessful for the past 8 years. And I think that the Iranian government is realizing, is well aware, that the U.S. is not here to play fair. The U.S. and Israel is not going to follow international law or ensure that proper procedures is followed when it comes to U.N. oversight for nuclear testing and different facilities. And so that's kind of the realization we're at, that this could spark a very deadly conflict or have very deadly results and be a disaster for the Middle East.
Thank you for that. Keaton Mansfield, author and analyst at the Center for Political Innovation. Thank you, Robert Fantina, author and journalist from Kushner. Moving on, resistance movement Hamas says the Israeli settlement projects are targeting the existence and identity of the Palestinian population. Hamas says that Palestinians will continue their resistance until the occupying forces are expelled from every inch of their territory. Data that Israel's expansionist projects will all end in failure. Israel says construction is already underway to double the settler population in the east of the occupied West Bank. All these settlements are illegal under international law. Palestinians are concerned about an Israeli bill which they say increases surveillance of their population under the pretext of curbing crime. A Palestinian legal defense organization says the new legislation gives Israeli police the free hand to search any Palestinian home without a court warrant. The organization is worried that the bill could be used to terrorize people and to increase tensions among Palestinians. Israel's parliament, the Knesset, is set to vote on the bill, but it is not yet clear whether the legislation will get a majority vote. Political commentator Mick Napier says the proposed Israeli legislation will broaden powers and give the regime's forces a green light to terrorize Palestinians in their own homes.
Israel considers itself to be a state for Jews. Jews who live in Palestine, yes, they were, in the recent law, they were deemed to be the only ones to have certain democratic rights. But it's also a state for Jews who live in Scotland or Iran or America or Russia. And it's not a state in its own constitution, such as they have, for the Palestinian citizens of that state. Now, that seems rather weird. But let it sink in. This state is not the state for the Palestinian citizens, and they are routinely described in Israeli academe as a demographic problem. They're described as a demographic problem at the top levels of Israeli politics. So they are people who are a problem for the state, and the state wants to be rid of them. Currently, they suffer from terrible segregation. Much poorer outcomes in terms of education, sewage, water, housing compared to Jews. It's really stark and very, very clear.
A deadly day in the Syrian capital. A twin bomb explosion has ripped through an army bus in Damascus, leaving 14 personnel dead and several others injured. The bombs went off as the bus was crossing under a bridge during the morning rush hour. The third bomb was defused. There had been no immediate claim of responsibility. Iran and the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah condemned the deadly incident. Tehran said that blind and cowardly acts of terrorism are doomed to fail and will not affect the steadfastness of the Syrian people to free their country from terrorists. Syria has experienced a number of gun and bomb attacks, especially after the army took over the last militant bastion near the capital in 2018. Political analyst Marcus Papadopoulos says that a coordinated attack in Syria shows that terror groups, including Daesh, are receiving training from Western forces.
My analysis of the attacks in Damascus shows that they were very well coordinated, very well planned, and they were brutally executed, which demonstrates that some very influential players in the world have been training these terrorist cells. So even though the advances of the Syrian army, the liberation of most of Syrian soil, cannot be rolled back now by the terrorist groups and their patrons, such as America, Britain, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, nonetheless, this is a way of the terrorists and their supporters inflicting losses on Syria. It is a way of keeping the fight going. It is a way of warning the Syrian people that they are not entirely safe in their towns and cities and villages throughout Syria. So I believe this attack is more of a psychological attack on the Syrian people.
Britain has reported over 49,000 new coronavirus cases and 179 related deaths in the past 24 hours. The country's total caseload now stands at over 8.5 million, which is the highest in Europe. Britain has the fourth highest COVID death tally globally, with more than 139,000 fatalities. As winter approaches, hospitals are likely to face severe pressure as the number of patients is on the rise. So far, more than 45 million Britons have been fully vaccinated against the virus, but the country continues to witness a relative surge in infections. Massive flooding and landslides have left a trail of devastation in India and in Nepal. Over 150 people are dead and dozens missing in both countries. The floods triggered by incessant rains have inundated acres of farmlands and residential areas in two Indian states, Uttarakhand in the north and Kerala in the south. Rainfall has exceeded 400 millimeters, with Indian Army personnel conducting search and rescue operations in some regions. Officials in Uttarakhand have said that locals are faced with a series of problems, as crops have been destroyed and roads are waterlogged. In neighboring Nepal, 77 fatalities have been reported. Dozens more remain unaccounted for. Heavy to very heavy rainfall is forecast for the coming days. The U.S. Naval Base in the state of Maryland has been placed under lockdown amid bomb and shooting threats. Authorities with the base in Montgomery County say that personnel were put inside of a shelter after an anonymous caller said there was a bomb near a building. Security personnel responded to the scene soon after. Later, officials at the base tweeted that there was no indication of an active shooter on the premise, but that the bomb threat was still being investigated. And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish. Unity Week. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. We are in the Unity Week. This week begins on the 12th and ends on the 17th of the Islamic month of Rabiul Awwal. Every nation owes its glory and grandeur to unity and solidarity. the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, removed all barriers of unity like racial discrimination, seeking of supremacy, ethnicity, and so on. He set up unity in the society in the general sense of the word. The corrupt and ignorant society of Arabia at that time was devoid of any rules of government or policy. In such circumstances, the Messenger of Mercy gathered all existing groups and ethnicities in Medina under his aegis. In today's episode of Unity Week, we are going to have a glance at some of the Prophet's measures to establish unity among Muslims. Stay tuned, please. The religion of the Prophet of Islam enjoyed programs and objectives for enhancement of people's cultural and intellectual level. These programs required a comprehensive establishment to implement. Had there not been the Prophet's prudence, precision, and insight, the Islamic government would not have materialized. One of the hindrances on the way of the Prophet was the lack of a coherent structure in the society. Every tribe and group had their own special customs, and there were myriads of contrasts and differences. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, however, employed a very calculated tactic to advance his goals. It was the rule of every Muslim is the brother of other Muslim. He created social unity to break up tribal and ethnic borders. This plan had many positive effects. Thus, the people of Medina, as the Ansar or helpers, warmly welcomed the people of Mecca or Mujahideen or migrants. This sympathy was to the extent that the people of Medina supported the migrants who had left their homes and hearths by sharing their houses with them and providing them financial assistance. Mosques had a significant role in the first years of Islam in bolstering unity and convergence. All Muslims took part in building the first mosque. Even the Prophet himself helped Muslims by bringing stones for the mosque. One of the companions approached the Prophet saying, "O Messenger of God, let me bring the stone." The Prophet said, "Go and fetch another stone." The mosque became the Prophet's house, place of worship, and the center of unity of the Islamic Ummah. Upon Islam's sunrise in Arabia and its rapid spread in the whole peninsula, Abu Amr, who was a Jew, was infuriated and tried to disintegrate the unity of Muslims through conspiring with hypocrites of the two tribes of Aus and Khazraj. He wrote in a letter to his accomplices, "Build a mosque in the village of Quba, opposite to the Mosque of Muslims, and gather together at the times of prayer so that the spiritual power of Muslims diminishes. Then, discuss the ways of overcoming Islam under the guise of performing prayer." When the Prophet set out for Tabuk battle, the delegates of hypocrites came up to him, saying, "O Messenger of God, the elderly and sick people cannot come to the mosque at rainy nights, so do you let us build a mosque in our neighborhood?" The Prophet looked at them thoughtfully, but didn't say anything. Then, As he saw their insistence, he said that he would deal with the problem after returning from the journey. Yet the hypocrites built a mosque in the absence of the prophet. When Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, came back to Medina, they asked him to inaugurate the mosque in praying in it. At that moment, Gabriel descended and exposed their conspiracy through revelation of Ayah 107 of Surah Tawbah, which reads, "As for those who took to a mosque for sabotage and for defiance, and to cause division among the faithful, and for the purpose of ambush by those who have fought Allah and His Apostle before, they will surely swear, 'We desired nothing but good,' and Allah bears witness that they are indeed liars." Then the Prophet ordered the mosque to be destroyed. In fact, this measure was aimed at preventing political rift and discord in the society. The agreements that the Prophet of Islam signed in Medina were among the most obvious approaches for unity in the Islamic society. The first agreement was concluded with the tribes and ethnicities in the city, which had been called by some as the first written constitution in the world. This prudent move was the best choice for creation of national unity and religious solidarity. Parts of the agreement read, "Muslims are a monolithic ummah separate from other people. They will be united against oppression, aggression, conspiracy, and corruption. If a difference emerges among Muslims, the reference for solution will be God and His Messenger. Muslims will not leave alone a heavily indebted person. They will rather help him." Other paragraphs of the agreement show the Prophet's effort to build unity and friendship in the society. Other parts of it read, "Muslims and Jews are a single community and live in Medina like a nation, while each of them has its own religion. The allied Jew will be helped. Muslims and Jews should struggle against those who rise against this agreement. Both of them should help one another to fight against aggressors to Medina." Dear listeners, unity does not mean that there must not be any difference in any matter. It does not mean either to follow a single language or set of rules. Muslims enjoy different languages, races, and ethnicities. Unity means being a single body against common enemies. It means to insist on shared beliefs and laws in pursuit of common goals. This unity was the key to make Muslims the masters of sciences and civilization for centuries. This is the element of success and glory today, too.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا O you who believe, اِسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Salam Alaikum. Now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم أما بعد فقد قال الله سبحانه وتعالى في كتابه الكريم واعتصموا بحبل الله جميعا ولا تفرقوا. Dear brothers and sisters in Iman, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I have begun with this verse from the Quran where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, hold on to the rope of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala altogether and do not be divided. Unity is a given. There is no need to discuss its importance. What is more important is to understand the concept of unity. What does it mean and how can we achieve it? What is the meaning of Ittihad Bain al-Muslimin? It does not mean that Muslims of all different sects and groups should amalgamate, you know, and become one, because that is not a possibility. If you try to unite two major groups by putting that together and becoming one, then you would actually be further creating more division, because the Shias would be there, the Sunnis would be there, and a new group will come up, probably known as Sushi. After all, the Prophet of Islam himself has said that verily my Ummah will divide after me into 73 sects. So that is not a possibility when we talk about inzimam or amalgamation of all the existing schools of thoughts. So what do we mean when we talk about wahda, unity, or ittihad bin al-Muslimin? A better term would be that we are talking about taqrib rather than ittihad. And taqrib here basically means that different groups should come closer to one another. And unity in that sense actually is based on two concepts. Number one, all the existing groups should accept one another in spite of diversity in their theology and jurisprudence. And number two, they should work on common challenges that they face in the world at the moment. These two points are the essentials as far as this movement of unity among Muslims is concerned. These two concepts actually are the pillars of unity of the Ummah. The first pillar basically is that both major groups, when we talk about the Shia and Sunni, should recognize one another as part of the global Ummah, that we are part of the Islamic circle. We may differ on theological and jurisprudential issues. We may debate on these issues, but this should all be done in a civil and academic manner, without using abusive language and style. In short, there should be no labeling of kufr against one another. This is the key to this unity. The scourge of takfiri mentality must be eliminated. Anyone who believes in the tawheed and monotheism of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the finality of the nubuwat of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and the life in the hereafter, that person is a Muslim. There will be differences in the fine points of these concepts also, as well as in the matters of jurisprudence. But we should learn to still recognize one another as Muslims, and we should learn to live with that diversity. When Sheikh Muhammad Abdul was made the head of the judiciary in Egypt, he promoted the idea of talfiq, in which a judge would not be restricted to one mabhab, one school of jurisprudence. He could pass the judgment based on any of the four mabahib of Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah. We should have the same kind of respect for one another, irrespective of differences in certain theological and jurisprudential issues. And so this is where the issue of, you know, mutual respect and acceptance comes in. We are not saying that, for example, we should pray one day according to the Sunni Hanafi fiqh and next day pray according to the Shia Ja'fari fiqh. you know, or when we go to the Sunni Muslim centers, we should fold our arms the way Sunnis do, or when the Sunnis come to the Shia mosque, they should, you know, put their hands down, unless, of course, they are Maliki. The point is that every Muslim should feel comfortable in exercising and practicing their own fiqh. There should be no issue of shying away from it. But we should have we should accept that diversity, but then also recognize one another as Muslims. The second point, which is the second most important pillar of this whole process for unity, is that Muslims, especially in the West, should realize that they face common challenges and problems. They must gather their resources and deal with their problems as a united force. The problems could be in the educational system for their children, or discrimination by the law enforcement agencies, or lack of representation in the legislation. In all these areas, the challenges are faced by all Muslims, irrespective of the faith, irrespective of the fact whether they are Sunni or Shia or Sufi or Wahhabi. Muslim students at the school face challenges in maintaining their religious identity and values, not because they are Shia or Sunni, rather because they are Muslims. Similarly, Muslims in the society face discrimination when dealing with the law enforcement agencies, not because they are Sunni or Shia, rather because they are Muslims or because they belong to a visible minority. Look at the numbers of Muslims in the Western countries these days. The numbers, alhamdulillah, are increasing. Yet they don't have a voice when decisions are made in the legislation. At that level, a united Muslim front will carry more weight than by looking at ourselves as Shia and Sunnis. We will be able to join and, you know, increase our numbers and have more weight when it comes to the issue of participating in the elections and have our voice on the table where the decisions are being made. If these two aspects are understood clearly, then unity will be meaningful, practical, and sustainable. Let me end with a story that I've been told by my late father, that during the days of President Ayub Khan in Pakistan, there was a Supreme Islamic Advisory Council that he had, and there was an issue that, you know, how do we end this sectarianism? And somebody in the meeting suggested to the martial law authority, Ayub Khan, that, you know, why don't you declare a command that everybody should, you know, unite and become one? And this is where Maulana Marhum Sayyid Muhammad Dahlawi, who was representing the Shia delegation in that meeting, he said that, you know, when we talk about unity of this kind, becoming one, may I suggest to you that why don't you issue a decree, a martial law decree, as a martial law administrator, that from now on, all the Pakistani Muslims will pray with their one hand down and one hand folded. And this is where Ayub Khan said, how can this be? This is not really practical. The point of Marhum Maulana Sayyid Muhammad Dehlavi was that you cannot mix things. Let a Sunni do their own things according to Sunni fiqh. Let the Shia do according to their own things. The main thing of unity is let us get rid of the scourge of takfiri mentality. Let us not use this term of kafir for one another. This will be the beginning of recognizing one another, respecting one another, and then we can move on to the front where we can basically deal with the common problems and challenges that we face locally as well as on the global level. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد. وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
In the limelight.
The intertwined challenges of COVID-19, hunger, and obesity graphically demonstrate U.S. National Geography of failed public health, says Joel Berg, writer, in an article published under the heading, Failing Public Health is Killing Americans Unequally. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Geography tells us important stories. The states that have suffered the most cases of COVID-19 in the U.S., mostly in the Southeast and Southwest, also have the highest rates of food insecurity, meaning that people can't always afford sufficient food, according to data recently released by USDA. These same states also have the highest rates of obesity. Why? It's not an issue of climate or soil or mere coincidence. It's about failed public policies. The top reasons for disproportionate COVID-19 cases in these regions are pretty obvious. Resistance to mask mandates, low rates of vaccination, and little promotion of social distancing throughout the pandemic. The reasons for high levels of hunger and diet-related chronic diseases should be equally obvious. Public policies that ensure low wages, high taxes on food, inadequate government safety nets, and widespread food deserts, whether healthier food is scarce. These states also have the U.S. highest rates of poverty. And while systematic racism is still a serious problem in every U.S. state, it's likely no coincidence that the three maps also overlap heavily with many states in the former Southern Confederacy, where the racial disparities in all these maladies remain particularly pronounced. These drivers of poor health are deeply interconnected, and each makes the other worse. Humans who are malnourished are more likely to have compromised immune systems and poor metabolic health, making them more likely to contract and transmit diseases such as COVID-19. Indeed, nearly two-thirds of COVID-19 hospitalizations may be related to common diet-related conditions. In communities with more COVID-19 cases, businesses where workers earn money to purchase food, schools, senior centers, and food charities where people obtain free meals have been more likely to be closed. The nutrition insecurity crisis fuels the pandemic and vice versa. Take Mississippi, for example. Per 100,000 people, Mississippi ranks in the top 10 states for COVID-19 cases endured since the onset of the pandemic. It also has the U.S. single highest rates of food insecurity, poverty, obesity, and just behind West Virginia diabetes. It is a grim irony that Mississippi also has the steepest sales tax on groceries, 7%. While obesity rates are high among Americans of all incomes due to complex physiological, emotional, genetic, and cultural causes, people suffering from nutrition insecurity and poverty have even higher rates. Since healthier food is often more expensive, more time-consuming to prepare, and harder to find in low-income communities than junk food, hunger and obesity are flip sides of the same malnutrition coin. When low-income humans are forced to skip meals, they're more likely to overeat when they do eat again. Obesity, as well as other diet-related diseases such as diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease, also make it more likely for people who get COVID-19 to die from it. Even before the pandemic, diet-related diseases were the top reason why this generation is the first in U.S. history to die earlier of natural causes than their parents. While these problems are most pronounced in certain regions, nutrition insecurity, poverty, and diet-caused diseases are a serious problem in every state, significantly harming wide swathes of suburban, rural, and urban America across every racial, ethnic, education, political, and income subgroup. Almost half the entire adult population in the U.S., more than 100 million adults, have pre-diabetes or diabetes. Fully 122 million Americans have cardiovascular diseases, resulting in roughly 840,000 deaths each year. Not only are the human costs devastating, but so too are the economic losses. The total cost to the U.S. of obesity is estimated at $1.72 trillion per year, or 9.3% of gross domestic product. As a nation, Americans spend about $1.1 trillion on direct costs for food and another $2.1 trillion on additional external costs of food from poor health, wasted natural resources, and lost livelihoods. In other words, for every $1 Americans spend on food, the nation economy loses an additional $2. House Rules Committee Chairman Representative Jim McGovern and many other public and private food leaders are right to be calling on the White House to convene a 2022 conference on food, nutrition, hunger, and health to draw together all key stakeholders, including federal, state, and local officials and food industry, to comprehensively address these grave threats. But U.S. states, cities, counties, and private sector should also take concrete, meaningful actions now on all these fronts. They should immediately increase vaccination campaigns and encourage mask wearing and social distancing in indoor public spaces. It should ensure that all jobs pay a living wage so that families can afford to buy the healthiest food. And when wages aren't enough to do so, they need to help as many eligible families as possible obtain healthy foods through federally funded nutrition programs such as SNAP, WIC, and school meals. States and cities should also incentivize farmers, markets, and grocery stores to deliver to food deserts, build healthier foods into their administration of Medicaid, and promote community gardens, urban farms, and food entrepreneurship. The intertwined challenges of COVID-19, hunger, and obesity graphically demonstrate U.S. national geography of failed public health. Smart public policies can move American states and communities from the bottom to the top of key national rankings. Geography doesn't need to equal destiny. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
November 25th, 2018. In a meeting with government officials of the Islamic Republic of Iran, ambassadors of Islamic countries and participants of the 32 Conference on Islamic Unity, practicing Islamic unity will allow Muslims to overcome all the schemes of the enemies of Islam. Today, the presence of powers and their oppression, originating from their audacity in perpetrating criminal activities, has caused the world to re-experience the days devoid of brightness and full of open deceitfulness. Today, too, humanity is unfortunately suffering again. This suffering is not particular to the world of Islam, rather all of humanity is suffering. Even those countries which apparently enjoy civilizational progress and worldly ostentation are suffering deeply. This suffering results from ignorance, deception, and a lack of justice. And Islam has a solution for all of these maladies. Islam guarantees the bliss and salvation of nations. We Muslims should learn this lesson.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, it should not be forgotten that by Allah's favor and grace, today the orientation of resistance against oppression and bullying exists in the world, one which is reliant on the name of God and Islam. Our region is an example in this regard. In our region, the spirit of Islamic awakening is prevailing in many nations and countries today. When you witness that arrogant powers of the world, headed by the criminal US, the great Satan, are sensitive about the region, the reason is that the orientation and inclination towards Islam and Islamic awakening are clearly noticeable in this region. They are opposed to the awakening of Muslim nations. They are afraid of the awakening of Muslim nations. Whenever Islam managed to dominate the hearts and lives of people, arrogance was slapped across the face, and we firmly believe that once more, arrogance will be slapped across the face by Islamic awakening in the region. This is the essence of what I wanted to discuss with our Muslim brothers, Muslim nations, the intellectuals of the world of Islam, and honorable religious scholars in Islamic countries.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.